This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to thank you, first of all, you, the audience, for coming here for this evening. Then I would like to thank my friends, Peter D'Agostino, Timothy Tracton, David Reed, and their companions, since they came also here. It's a great pleasure to see you again. And I would also thank Lutz Deutloff, Günter Schuster, and Miss Heider from New York. But above all, I have to thank Aaron, Jean-Michel, and Osvaldo from the Slot Foundation for giving me this great pleasure and privilege to speak to you and to speak with you. Because tonight we have a tough program. This rewriting program you will see is a tough program, but I will make it as enjoyable as possible. So let's join in a kind of an experiment. And the experiment will be to rethink and to reframe and even to rewrite some of our ideas and concepts and knowledges and facts, so-called facts about art. I mentioned, let's join together an experiment, but before we continue this experiment, I have to remember you what an experiment is, because today, in our 20th century, an experiment is something which is marginal in art. It is something which is even mentioned pejorative. A friend of us, Peter Kubelka, a famous filmmaker, he was called experimental filmmaker, and he always said, no, I'm not an experimental filmmaker, because he felt be called experimental, or experimental painter, or experimental musician is nothing. The reason is that our 20th century is not as brilliant as people think, because the term experimental art comes from a very high point in the 19th century. It was formulated by a wonderful writer, Émile Zola. So one of the greatest champions of novels in the 19th century, he wrote a book in 1880 called Le Roman Experimental, the experimental novel. So you see, experiments means not something pejorative, something marginal. Experiment means something completely different. And I will explain you very shortly what it means. In this book, Le Roman Experimental, Émile Zola referred to another book by a doctor of medicine, Claude Bernard. It was called Introduction to the Study of Experimental Medicine, which appeared 1865, 2 years before another experimental book appeared, Le Capital, The Capital by Karl Marx. Very good moment in history. And what did Zola? Zola took the book by Bernard, Introduction to the Study of Experimental Medicine, and said, we just replace the term doctor through novelist, and the term medicine through novel. Because he said, I want the same, like Bernard. Bernard was the founder of the medicine as science. This is the point. And to make it a scientific discipline, he had to introduce the idea of an experiment to prove his theories. And therefore he said, I am as a novelist, I do the same. I want to turn literature into a science. I make a citation from Zola. Medicine was just an art, but now with Bernard it becomes a science. Literature was just an art, but now with experimental methods it becomes a science. So what we do today when we make an experiment, and we'll do it together, is to make the science, to turn art into a science, and even better, to turn art history. We attempt to turn art history into science. And what my idea is, I call you what is called rewriting program. Rewriting has different meanings. It has a very technical meaning. At the end of the lecture, you will have a technical description. But it has also a metaphorical meaning. And I give you some example when you go forward, what rewriting could mean. I said history is always rewriting. There's no origin and no end. But now let's take a small window of some remarkable things. Marzipan, as you know, is something sweet to eat. But you cannot imagine where the term marzipan came up. It was 1,000 years after Christ that in Byzantine Empire there was a silver coin, and the silver coin was Jesus Christ sitting on the throne. The Arabs called this Jesus Christ sitting on the throne and a coin, so they called it the sitting king. And the Arab word was maftaban. Then this coin was taken by the Venetians in the 12th century, and they called it Dandolo. And they called it Mataban. And then the custom in Venetia collected texts from Cyprus, yeah, and they called this custom text also Mataban, yeah, because the boxes where things had been transported, yeah, had the image of this coin on top of it. This is something very familiar in language. We call it metonymy. Yeah. I make one explanation to understand further. The greatest scientist of the greatest linguist in the 20th century, Roman Jakobson, I will come back to him several times, he said language operates on two axes. One axis is metaphor. That means when I say, I beg you on the knees of my heart. Yeah? This is a nice metaphor you can always use. Yeah? And then we have what we call metonymy, yeah? Means we drink a glass. Naturally, we don't drink the glass because then we would have blood in our mouth. Yeah? But we drink the wine, which is contingent to the glass. Yeah? And these topological characteristics that language is speaking always in this kind of metaphor, a metonymy, yeah? Is also, you see it here, because the boxes had imprinted the silver coin, Jesus Christ sitting on the throne, yeah? And therefore even the content was called Mataban. Yeah? And finally, in 16th century, that means after 600 years, the French people said, this inside of these boxes, these three things, yeah? We call them a marzipan. You see now, yeah? A word for something to eat needs 600 years to come from a Byzantine coin. Another example. Sequin, in Italian language, zecchino, is a gold coin of pure gold, made in Venice, 1284. And it is called after the building where this coin was made. And the building has the name Zecca. Again, the same thing. You have a glass, and inside the glass is wine. You have a building. Inside the building, you make a coin. And then the coin gets the name of the building, Zecca. And then later, on this coin was printed the Doge from Venice in front of the Holy Marcos. And it was dedicated to Jesus Christ in Latin language. And it said at the end, Christe datus quem tu regis iste ducatus. Dedicated to Christus the King. And therefore today we speak about ducatus, about ducats, about coins. So you see again, there's always a transformation in history. And now comes the point that you go into art history to see how in art this transformation works. So first, what is the problem? I show you case studies. I show you case studies of the problem. It was Duchamp here in Philadelphia who was very aware of the problem, and he gave him a name. Please read it. Artists of all times are like gamblers of Monte Carlo. So it's art history is a blind lottery. And even posterity is a real bitch who cheats some, reads at others, and is also free to change his mind every 50 years. So what Duchamp is saying, in fact, there's no just art history. There's not justice in the world, we know it, but there's not even justice in art or in art history. He says art history doesn't exist. It is not only justice which is blind, art history is blind. Artists are like gamblers in Monte Carlo. So he denies, in fact, the possibility of art history as science. And we have to take seriously Duchamp because he's the founder of modern art, of modernism. Therefore, we have Prakhan Dmitrievich, and it's a wonderful coincidence that we had just a show here with Prakhan Dmitrievich. I didn't know it, because Prakhan Dmitrievich was a follower of Duchamp, and he made it very clear because he wrote this wonderful story. In a time long, long ago, they lived in a village, two painters. The king was on the road. The dog lost his tracks, so he followed the dog in the guard of a painter. And when he looked at the painter, he liked the work, and therefore Leonardo da Vinci became a famous man. If the dog would have taken another route, would have moved to the other garden, then Leonardo da Vinci would not exist, and then it would be Andelko Hundic, who would be a famous artist. And there is a wonderful example of the lottery of art history. Leonardo himself is a very good example, because this is his most famous, Mona Lisa, his most famous drawing. And people think it is a drawing by Leonardo. But in fact, it is not. It is just a simple illustration. An illustration which was done by many, many artists. So it was for Dürer and many, many artists before the Renaissance, in the Renaissance, made drawings like this, because the inventor of this drawing is Vitruv. architect who lived 100 years before Christ there, and who was forgotten. So only in medieval ages he had some 80 books out in circulation in the world, but he was rediscovered in the Renaissance. Yeah? And then reading his book, yeah, because it was easy, it was a bestseller at that time, yeah? Then Leonardo came up on this passage, as you can see, yeah? And just as a human body yields a circular outline, so too a square figure may be found from it. For if he measures that distance from the soles of the feet to the top of the head, and then applies that measures to the outstretched arms, the breadth will be found to be the same as the height, as in the case of plane surfaces which are perfectly square. So the idea, you see, is precisely from the truth. He was just a simple illustrator, not the only one. Huh? But he became famous by misunderstanding. So therefore I can predict you, if you are a working artist, look and try to be misunderstood. Give the audience a chance to make a mistake in the judgment. Try to make a work which can be misunderstood. This is a very good chance to survive, huh? Like you see here. Huh? Coming back to Duchamp, even here, huh, with Duchamp, he had the same fate. There exist people who say that this woman, Baroness Elsa von Freytag-Lottinghofen, Mother Schamberg is only the photographer. Yeah? And you see, this is a sculpture called God. It's done out of plumb from a sink. Yeah? And there are people, because there's a letter from Duchamp to his sister, yeah? And I don't go into Duchamp questions because we have experts here, yeah? But only give you a report what is the status quo of research. They say that this piece is not by Duchamp, that this piece is by Baroness Elsa von Freytag-Lottinghofen, a crazy artist in New York who was in much favor of Duchamp, she was in love with Duchamp. Yeah? And he wrote a letter to his sister saying, a friend of mine will show a toilet urinal at an exhibition. Yeah? And this letter is the reason that many people think maybe she is the author. There's even a very famous woman called Rhonda Roland Shearer. Yeah? She's a little bit, I think, persona non grata in the circles of Duchamp. And she says that all the ready-makes are fake. Yeah? Yeah. And she says, for example, he published a magazine, Duchamp, in the 70s. This magazine was called Wrong, but written with one W. Yeah? And she said, this magazine was made like this. Wrong printer, wrong magazine, wrong ready-mates. Wrong us about the ready-mates. She says, even the work of Duchamp non would tell my ready-mates are non-ready-mates. Yeah? So we have a person who is a very scientific person. She was a woman of Jay Gould, an eminent paleontologist in Harvard. Yeah? So she is a scientific person who tries to prove all the time that Duchamp made fakes. So even here, with such a figure, yeah, like Duchamp, the founder of modern art, we have doubts about the dates and about the originality and the authorship. The same could happen to Pablo Picasso. You see, he made the piece, this glass of absinthe, 1 year before Duchamp. Yeah? And nobody makes a connection to the piece of Bernard Oppenheim, because in fact it was like this, that he was sitting in a restaurant, and he explained to Bernard Oppenheim, a young model with Man Ray, yeah, what he did in his youth, for example, with his glass of absinthe. And then he mentioned to her, you see, we're sitting in the restaurant and we could do the same. You could take this coffee cup, yeah, and surface it with fur, and people would say it's a work of art. So Meredith Oppenheim went home and she did it. Yeah? And this is her only work which became famous. Another nice misunderstanding. Yeah? And then comes the rewriting. Yeah? You saw the sink. Yeah? And now comes people like Paul Teck, yeah? She rewrited, and now comes another one. It could go on forever, Robert Gober. Yeah. And then he takes another program from the Surrealists, as you will see, yeah. Legs coming out from two holes, like Jean Cocteau, the Blood of a Poet, two arms coming out from the holes. He made constructed corridors where arms come out, etc. So this is one of many, many examples that art is a rewriting of things that exist. Huh? Here's a next study case. These photographs of Rudolf Schwarzkeller have been exposed at Documenta 72. No? And then was an article by Robert Hughes, the so-called serious magazine called Time magazine. Yeah? And he wrote an article scandalizing these photographs and saying, this is the end of modern art, well, because you see an artist here. Modern art goes so far that an artist not just mutilates his ear, like Van Gogh, he mutilates his penis, yeah, and then during this mutilation, as a public action, he died. Yeah. So he made a self-castration as a performance, and this is shocking and horror, and it's terrible. Yeah. Then came another artist, Leslie Vine, he answered, yeah, and he said, no, we have to defend it. Yeah. It's very good art. Yeah, yeah. So the point is, so we have one who, Hughes, who says this is a terrible art, it's a shock of modern art, it's a prime example. And then we have artists and artist groups like Leslie Vine who say, no, this is wonderful art, brilliant art, you should do like things like this. The fact is, and this is now a horrible story, what you see here is not Schwarzkogler at all. It is a model. And this is not an action, it is staged photography in his apartment. So it's black and white photography, as you see. You take a model, you have a photographer. So Schwarzkogler was just standing aside with his suit and a cravat, and saying to the model, make it like this, make it like that. He had an assistant, and he had a photographer. It was a normal photo session. And what you see here is black ink on the penis. It's not blood. But naturally, for the camera, it's no difference. So in fact, it's not a model. So it's a model, it's not the artist himself. It's just the image, the representation of castration. But here you see precisely what I will explain later. That people, when they look at the work, they just interpret it after their own desire. We will go deep in this thing, what happens when representation is mixed with reality, when representation is not saying something about what you see, but it is saying something about people think and feel. You know from Nana? So then we have Bruce, who cut his skin because he said, the body is my medium. Yeah? And when somebody is cutting a screen, then why not chop my body, which is also a screen? And the strange thing was, when he did it, and I did similar things, then we had a lot of psychiatrists, and the state and the police and said, this is psychopathological. Then I said, okay, if this is pathological, I said, when I had to defend myself, then I said, why then this is not pathological? Here's also somebody cutting the skin. So when you speak about pathological art, then you should start earlier, not just start with us. Then you should go back call whole art activity pathological. Because this is what you really see here, is the beginning of what is called action art. I give you more examples. So you have seen the urinoir of Duchamp, when you continue, when you don't have the object, because the urinoir was an object not to use, and when you suddenly make pissing, etc., and defacing, then suddenly the question is it art or is it not art? But nobody asks the question, if you look at urinoir of Duchamp, is it art or not art? So when you suddenly show the function of an object in a performance, the use value, then suddenly people have doubt if it's art or not art. I don't know. My point is not to declare this question. I don't say this is art. I only show you a case study of the problems. Or here, this is the early Nietzsche, how he showed his work. He showed a victim of a crime, and then the next photo is his own art. And then you see on the other photograph, you see a victim of a crime, and above you see a photograph of his own art. So he linked his art to crimes, to explain what his art is. Now we have a little bit further. What is the meaning of this kind of work? We have to rethink the idea of representation. This is now our first serious step to reprogram art history and art. We have to rethink the idea of representation because we think normally representation is only about the visible world. But naturally we know that we have also to represent what is repressed. What is unconscious. We cannot just talk about representation, what we see. We must also represent, we must find a way how to represent the unconscious, the repressed, etc. And the model is the famous Wunderblock by Freud. I don't go into it, it would take too long. Just mentions that Freud and Derrida look at representation as a trace. They don't look at representation as a picture. They say it's a trace of something that happened. And therefore, when you look at a piece as a trace, you can say it is a representation of the repressed and unconscious. And how is this possible? Something what Ludwig Wittgenstein, yeah, the famous philosopher, said 1946 about psychoanalysis. He said, what Freud says about the unconscious sounds like science, but in fact it's just a means of representation. This is wonderful. Yeah? Precisely this is the idea. We have the possibility to represent the unconscious in certain ways. To make a long story short, I show what is happening here. Psychoanalysis has this model of the ego, that the ego is in a boundary between the it, the S, which is biology, and between the super ego, what are the demands of the society. So you are a simple human subject, and you have some biological drives, you want to do something, you have desire, but then you have the super ego, society, who tells you what is allowed and what is not allowed. Nature, this puts a lot of pressure on the subject, on the ego, and therefore the ego develops defense mechanism. The Freud daughter, 1936, she wrote the book, The Ego and the Defense Mechanism. And we have many defense mechanisms to protect our ego. One is called repression, denial, regression, rationalization, displacement, projection, introjection, sublimation, and above all, in my opinion, so-called reaction formation. So it's a technical term. What is reaction formation? For example, you can displace your desire. It is a redirection of an impulse to a symbolic substitute. You know many of these people who hate men and people, but then they love God. They love their cats and dogs. So their cats and dogs are replacing the human beings. Because people don't like people, but they like cats and dogs. This is a famous displacement. Or what Anna Freud called a displacement outward, a man who has sexual feelings about his friend, so he has homosexual feelings, but cannot acknowledge this feeling under the pressure of the society, he becomes increasingly complaining about the presence of homosexuality in society. So he makes his displacement outward. You see, he feels himself under pressure. He cannot say, I'm a homosexual. But suddenly, then he takes it a displacement outward and says, oh, there are so many homosexuals out in the world. There's a famous case in the United States, Mr. Cohen, a consultant of Nixon. He was himself a homosexual, but the greatest hunter of homosexuality in public spaces. This is a classical defense mechanism. So defense mechanisms are processes how the ego adopts the reality principle. So reaction formation is also just believing the opposite. Adolescent can speak about, for example, when you remember in your school time, many young men say, it's so boring to speak with girls. This is a very usual phrase. And the fact it is, adolescents can speak about opposite sexes as being annoyed only to hide the overwhelming desire. What they do, in fact, want to speak all the time with the girls, but they cannot say what they really want. So they say, oh, I don't speak with the girls because she's dull or boring. But this just hides the fact that they want only one thing, to speak with this woman. That means a human being can project its own unacceptable activities onto others, but also project other unacceptable activities into itself, a kind of inverse displacement. And this is precisely what happens here, in this kind of art. It is not an analysis of our society, but it is a reaction formation of what has happened in our society, these crimes during the war, which people cannot speak about. So we have a traumatic society. Trauma means precisely this. Something happened you cannot speak about, and when you start to speak about it, it is so tough that people don't listen to you. And therefore, when everything is repressed, and when you have a society behind you, with all these crimes, you have we could desire artists who really can deal with it. But artists are on the same epistemological level like other people. Therefore, they can only make a reaction formation to react against the traumas of the Holocaust and the one, all of the things which happened during the Second World War. So in fact, we have here an example how the crisis of representation could be overcome. I come to this back later. Another case study, here's an action which I did with my expert 68. But in each picture, it was announced on the poster as a camera action. But then in the feminist literature, I was always not mentioned. because it is very clear that the feminist doesn't want to show this touching a breast, but then this was the idea. So this was normally you go in a cinema, but we made a small cinema, you could only go in with your hands, and said you didn't see a naked breast, you could touch a naked breast. And I gave, we did it together, and as you see, when you see me with the megaphone, I was explaining it to the audience what is going on and what does it mean. And then actually for the feminist literature, it was much better that this is not done with a couple. It is much better we have a singular heroine who does it by its own. And this is nice paradoxes. While the expert publishes always this photograph under her name and says it's from 1970, but at the same time she says, I invented my name 1968. But how is it possible to say two opposite things? At one time to say, I invented my own name 1968, but then saying it comes from this smart export cigarette calling herself Vale Export. So it's a clear contradiction, but the blindness of ideological will makes this contradiction invisible. In fact, it's easy to remember where this name could come from. It comes from Andy Warhol's factory, because Andy Warhol has invented the superstars, and he has already Ingrid Superstar and Velvet International. So I said to her, the only name we can make is, since Superstar and International is already occupied, monopolized, so we call you Expert. But it feels much better in the ideology when a woman can say, I invented myself. Even when the contradiction is evident that 2 years later, it was published documents and saying, I took my name from the secret smart export. Another case study. How is it possible that the Amish religious sect make modern art? How is it possible that you have modern art before modern art? We could discuss it for a long time, but let's allow me a short answer, but I think the arguments are overwhelming. The argument is that these two, the Amish quilts and abstract modern art, have the same source. It is religious sects. Modern art, in fact, as many arguments say, is a spiritual sect. You can be say it's not true, but then go back to read the essays of Kandinsky, of Mondrian, and even from Hugo Ball, the Dadaist. They say, when you look at the painting of Kandinsky, writes Hugo Ball, the famous Dadaist, then you must look at it like an altar in the church. So this language, how people speak about abstract art, is completely religious. And the sources for Mondrian and Kandinsky have obscure religious sects. And naturally, they all have the same Protestant idea, the forbidding of the image. You are not allowed to make an image of God, you are not allowed to make an image of the world. So we impose, so modern art has traces of religious sects. And now I'll show you another version. So we start to rewrite history. As you see now another version. These are the famous photographs. We are still in the idea of case studies. These are photographs of Ernst Mach. Of the flying bullets. It was a wonderful thing. You could photograph the resistance of the air to a flying bullet. And you see, this was a visual language for the futurists. This was a visual language even for Kenneth Noland. And even when you go today to your video recorder and you have to say forward or fast forward, you have the same sign. So we have sources that we can explain very rationally what's going on. But people don't know these sources. For example, people speak about Mark Roscoe. It's explained all the work of Mark Roscoe by religious terms. Even when Mark Roscoe himself was a convinced social democrat, his book just published was called Art is a Social Act. Art is a Social Activity. But this doesn't matter. Art historians think we have to interpret it religiously, but in fact, it comes not from religion. It comes from Mach, Ernst Mach. You see, he discovered this effect of the famous Mach pens. How, you see, it's the same painting which is rotating. It's from around 1900. And naturally, your eye, when you have a borderline between very dark and very bright, the eye can make a switch. It can see everything inside can be very white or can be very dark. So this technique is called inhibition technique. So I can suppress something, yeah? And suddenly when you impress the dark part, it becomes too light, and when you suppress the light part, it becomes too dark. Yeah? So in Mark Roscoe, yeah, when people would go and study his lectures, would realize that he, in fact, had a book about Mach. Yeah? So he knows the effect, and he used it for his painting. Yeah? So we have a scientific background to explain, yeah, the condition for contrast and comparison, etc., to explain in a scientific way. But nobody goes to the sources. I'm the only one who makes this connection. Yeah? And also now comes the even much worse case. Yeah? You know these images from atomic bomb in Japan. Hmm? Yeah. This is the next image, yeah? The victims. Yeah? And now you see a work by the Guta group, and you see very clearly, they try to, it's this, what I called reaction formation, yeah? To react against the horror of this atomic bomb. Yeah? See again, yeah? It's a restaging, yeah? A reenactment. Yeah? The next, and these are the photographs of traces of men in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Images of burned people in the ground. Yves Klein was 1952 and 90 cities for 2 years in Japan because he was into a kind of Japanese technique of fighting. I have forgotten the name, something. How do you call this when people have these belts? Judo or something like this. Okay. See, and then he saw these photographs. And he was naturally so impressed that he had precisely what I said before, the crisis of representation. Yeah? And the crisis of representation has two historic moments. So one was 1915, when Malevich and the others said, you are not allowed to depict the world of objects, we make abstract art. And then said Duchamp, okay, if you're not allowed to make a picture of an object, then I show the real object, yeah? Which is a strange paradox. Yeah? And one artist group says, we are not allowed to make even a picture of an object, and the other artist group says, in precisely 1915, we show the picture, we show the object itself. And after the war, we had the same answer. Adorno, the famous philosopher, critical philosopher, said, after Auschwitz, you cannot make a picture, you cannot make a poem anymore. You cannot represent the horror. And the inventor of the Holocaust studies, Raoul Hilberg, yeah, he said just the opposite. If you want to show a picture of Germany, you can't show a picture. You must take a real Cyclone B, this gas, with the help of this gas, the Jews have been murdered. Yeah? So you make an empty room, and you place in this room Cyclone B. Only the real object is the real gas. So again, this was the answer like Duchamp. We show the reality. Yeah? And the other answer was from Adorno. You are not allowed to show reality. You are not even allowed to represent reality. So we have two times the crisis of representation. And naturally, the artists could not find a way out, so they made what I call reaction formation. And I show you some examples. You see? He goes back. Yeah? In his, he makes his fireworks again. Yeah? And it looks precisely like the photographs he has seen. Yeah? The same people, you see? Yeah? You see? Producing a fire color. So he's repeating in this process precisely this act of destroying the idea of humanity. And some people will say, Peter, this is a nice theory, but I don't believe it. So I say, okay. So I show you this picture, which is called Hiroshima 61. Yeah. So, and then I could show people texts where he speaks about Hiroshima. Yeah. But when you saw a show by Yves Klein in the Centre Pompidou last year, there was not one single word about Hiroshima. And they did show this picture because this is much more fun, yeah, to show naked women as a spectacle, yeah, for the tourists. Yeah, yeah, because they think tourists have no idea, so they act like television. They say tourists, we have to treat tourists and visitors of our museum like people who watch television. Yeah, which just gives them the worst ideas. Yeah, yeah. It goes so far, for example, when you go to the Tate Britain, yeah, they had a show about post-impressionists. Yeah? They showed the wonderful Sickert, post-impressionist British painter, and he deliberately said, I don't paint like Degas dancers, I paint prostitutes to show the poverty of Britain. Yeah? And you saw in the show never the word prostitutes. Yeah? So this is a strange thing, yeah? When art history and art museums are denying the truth of what they show. Yeah? And the worst case I know is these pieces of Yves Klein. Yeah? Because on one side, we have the formalist and Marxist who say to Yves Klein, He is just repeating, as an avant-garde, the inventions of the avant-garde before the war. And the others, who are not Marxists, they make him into a spectacle. But in fact, if Klein is precisely like the actionist, and therefore the Vienna actionists came from Klein, they are making reaction formation as a way out of the crisis of representation. Ah, yeah. Now comes the best part. Here we have some examples of many examples how the media and the photography is dealing with Freud. You see, there's a book called by Peter Brückner, Sigmund Freud, Private Lecture, and you see an apartment, and people think this is a library of Sigmund Freud, but it is not. It would have been very easy to take the real photographs, but people didn't want to show it. Or above, you have a book about Freud, a big famous book about Freud, showing us the apartment of Freud and showing us a couch. But in fact, it is not. It is not true. What you see here is not Freud's apartment, not Freud's couch. This is strange. And then you see a wonderful article, Freud's Loyal Pearl. And this was an article, you see Freud's Faithful Pearl. It was an article about the servant of Freud, who helped him to make his household. But in fact, it is the daughter of Freud. So you have many of these examples. When people make books with photographs about Freud, that say have the wrong photographs. And naturally, it is again erection formation. In fact, all these books are secretly against Freud. And this impulse, this drive is so strongly that they make the wrong erections. So the author, Peter Brückner, hates, in fact, so much the lecture of what Freud is thinking that he is not able to show the true picture. He has what I wrote before, this kind of displacement. So he doesn't take the real place, the real photography, he displaces it, he shows another apartment. So we have here many, this is only a case study. I could show you for hours material I've collected to show how even so-called photographic documents are misdirected because of this positive or negative direction formation. So the seriousness of intent of the text emphasizing Freud's extraordinary importance for the world, which then failed to properly illustrate his real home, must be doubted. And nature is clearly an indication of the repressed aggression and resistance. But sometimes, and now comes our point, it can even tell the truth. Because when you see her, the woman, as the daughter of Freud, and not the household, the caretaker, the housekeeper, then in fact it says something about the role of Freud's daughter. She was really his pearl. She really was just taking care of his work. So we have even all possibilities that the suppressed reality, even in lying, even in fake, you can get the truth. This is our point of hope. So we don't believe anymore in this program of rewriting that people will tell you the truth, or that art will tell you the truth. Only when this is what Nietzsche already had an idea, when art, or so-called art, is working with this erection formation, with this repression, being beyond the crisis of representation, we have a chance to know something about the truth when art, in some sense, is not telling the truth. And this gives, and I can show you mathematical models how this is possible to do. Now we have possible solutions. I make it very short. This film may be a hook. We have in the last year a tendency of so-called reenactments, when people reenact what we have seen in cinema. For example, there's this film Straw Dogs. There was a bank robbery, then Scorsese made a film about Straw Dogs, then Pierre Huyck took the man who made the robbery and restaged the film and the real robbery, so you had four levels of observation and reenactions. This is a film above from Konrad Westphal about German demonstrations in 68, and then a remake of this film by Felix Melin. This is a Battle of Orgrave. It's not a documentary. So Jeremy Deller took people who restaged it for him. So it's not a documentary. So he reenacted the battle and he documented it. Omar Fast, he interviews people who have been players in the in Schindler's List, and now it's called Schindler's List, to show how several points of observation, degrees of observation, can obscure a story. This is a very interesting piece, one of the better reenactments. As we know, the Romanian Revolution was a stage revolution for television and by television. Yeah? And therefore, you see, he is asking people to come and audit for a role as revolutionary leader, and since this is documented. So people sit in front of television, like in reality, and make auditions. So you learn, by this faking, by this mockery, you learn that the real revolution was also only an audition. It was not really real. You see a chance of art by representing the oppressed, that you can tell the truth about the repression. I did similar things, like always, years before. I did a reenactment of a Nazi window in Graz, and I turned it back into a Nazi shop, and it says, "We don't buy these shoes. This shoe is in a canvas to protect him." And I didn't say this art. There was no, as you see, it was just a normal shop, so people did not protest it because they thought time is coming back, and we like it. If I would have said it is art, it would be a clear case of representation. They would have protested and would say, art is not allowed, like Adorno, or like to make some things. Even when inside the shop I had old radios and I had prizes of the German time, of the 30s, as a German Denmark in Austria, and it was very easy to decipher. People believed that this is just the time coming back. And then I did reenactments of Duchamp, because Duchamp calls his Topage Etalon his most important work. It is derived by Poincaré. It's against the matter, against all measurements. So it is far ahead in thinking of the physics of his time. He followed Poincaré, but he predicted what we call to the chaos theory. So I reconstructed it as an action, 1970. And then I reconstructed also other places. I said to a gallery, let's make the three classes of a dining room a ship, first class, second class, third class. You can imagine they didn't allow me. So, learning this, I made a show in a big museum. They wanted a retrospective, said, but no, I want to make a show called Construction of Art History. I invent artists, I invent a painter. But the painter is so much a painter that it doesn't allow to reproduce his images. This is a really highest abstraction. When you're not allowed to reproduce or to represent reality, then I go even further. I say, I don't allow to even represent my paintings because now they're an object. So the catalog, this part was always empty. And I called myself V, double V, my name, the last painter. Then I invent another, a mix of Rudi Dutschke and Marcel Duchamp. He was a political artist, and it's called Police is Lying. So I made photographs correcting public statements. Then my favorite down there, from now on, 24th December, this day is declared as a National Money Day, where every man has free access to everyone's bank account. This would be a nice Christmas present for everybody. And everybody of us would have free access to everybody's bank account. So would equal justice would be easy to be made in a Christian philosophy. Then another, justice is just an error of justice. And other pieces. Then I made some models of architecture. This is a deconstructed room of the museum, it shows a background. Then this is a school of a new social research in New York, designed by an Austrian, Joseph Urban. I remade it as a furniture. The Guggenheim Museum is a bar. This is best analysis what the Guggenheim is really doing. You see, we have nothing to do. This is a method, what I said, rewriting. You just make it smaller. I didn't change anything. I just made it smaller, and then in the inside you can lean around, you have inside in the circle, you have the drinks here. It's a very comfortable bar. Then I took away from the toilet the names of ladies and gentlemen. So when the people went onto the toilet, they had to find out themselves what is a toilet for men and for women. And then when the museum director saw it, they made these two sculptures with Homme and Dame, so like from Lacan. Then the museum director said to me, naturally, are you crazy? You have to give back these names to the toilet doors. Yeah, this was a model I showed, you see, an early vision of what can happen. I showed it 84, this piece. Sculpture in public space. Then another artist. So I invented many, many artists. So when my gallery came in, there's a show. Yeah? Duchamp's bicycle changed there. I'm as a media artist there. So when my galleries came in the show, then she said, Peter, you are here as a curator, but where's your work? Yeah? I'm your gallerist, please show me your work. Then I said, see, and then I said, you see, all what you see here is my work. It's just disguised as other names. So the introduction to the catalog was called Errata. And I wanted to show that not only art is a collective fiction, a collective rewriting, that even our life could be a fiction. And by all of these ideas, what I have as an artist, naturally, I make also my shows and my exhibitions, my books. Now we go a step further. Another solution mentioned by Duchamp. All in all, the creative act is not performed by the artist alone. The spectator adds his contribution to the creative act. Said 57. So he is now saying the spectator is part of the artwork. To make it more abstract, what you observe as a visitor in a museum in front of an artwork, you are part of the system that you observe. Okay, I repeat. The contribution to the creative act is besides this. You are part of the system that you observe. Duchamp looked from close during 1 hour. So he gives you an instruction what to do, how to look at it. Brancusi was even more far ahead. The only problem with Brancusi was he was a little bit conservative because he made with his hand his own artwork. This is strange in modernist, because as you know, the modern painters don't even make an image anymore. No? Andy Warhol was not able to make one image in his lifetime. No? He took all the images from the mass media. Yeah? This is very clever because he knew the images who make it to the mass media are very popular, like Elvis Presley, Liz Taylor, whatever, Ronald Reagan. So when you take the same images that already have been popular, then my art will become also popular too. So he was what today we call in economics derivatives. Is this English, derivatives? So you see, he said, what is accepted by the mass media and popular, I will paint it again. Not even paint it, just things printed. And then I have another advantage. Daily papers know that they are not a good storage medium. Every daily paper disappears next day. But painting is a storage medium for immortality, because normally you have in painting you have portraits of people who are famous and stay there forever. Bishops, heroes of wars, etc. So, but magazines have a storage problem. They disappear every day. But now when somebody comes like Gerhard Richter or Andy Warhol and brings his mortal daily papers to the medium of immortality called painting, then the mass media say, you did a nice job. You saved our storage problem. Because now we are in a museum. Naturally, psychoanalytically speaking, it shows a castration complex. Because, what I said before, formation reaction, because knowing that this kind of painting has no future anymore, what I said before, there's an outward direction here. You just admire the mass media which destroy you. You also say, what you, there's this famous saying, what you cannot destroy, you should kiss. This is not something about human relations. So the enemy which you cannot destroy, you must make him to your partner. And this is precisely the heart of the castration complex. So that people like Gerhard Richter and Andy Warhol say, embrace the enemy of painting, and they paint him to be safe. Here, Brancusi, he was a little bit conservative. He made his own artwork. But what is great about him, you see, this sculpture could be an abstract sculpture, and even use it as an abstract sculpture. But he also says it's a stool. You can sit on it. So we have already a double function. And then he also uses it as a pedestal to put another sculpture on top of it. So it has three functions. So he's really the best, because Duchamp did not accept the use value of his objects. He is the first Brancusi to make abstract sculpture to a use value. So he did not only say we have an exchange value. As Marx said, he said we have also a use value. And art can be part of the use value. Then it was taken over by Nicolas and Fall, for example. You can take a fusil, a rifle, and shoot on a painting, and then it's your painting. So then finally, with Manzoni, the public became the object of art itself. So the user, the spectator, becomes the object of art. It went on, Franz Erhard Walter in the 60s, he called this art objects to use. And slowly, you see, with these instructions, yeah, yeah, this is contemporary artist, yeah, you put it as a whole, you put your hand in as a whole, yeah, you see, on the end, you obey this instruction of use and stay in this position for a minute, then make a photograph, then you have 1 minute sculpture of Erwin Wurm. He's now so famous that even this group from California, a rock group, Red Hot Chili Peppers. Maybe you have seen the latest videos of Red Hot Chili Peppers. The whole video is made after Erwin Wurm's 1 minute sculptures. It was in the middle, started with Nam June Paik Participation TV. You have a microphone, you speak something, and you see an abstract image. Or you make your own, you take out from the monitor, from the recording machine, you take out the head, the recording head, and you can move around. And since these are tapes, so you can make your own music. Yeah. So this is a piece I did myself in ZCAM. You go in a photo machine, you make a photograph, it is immediately digitized, and then you see yourself on this monitor, and then inside, as an exhibition, you see yourself projected. So you are the creator of the work of art, and you are content of the work of art, and you are part of the museum. This is precisely what I think, what is photography about. Photography is a democratic medium. Everybody can make a picture. Everybody can have a picture about himself. Painting is not the case. Painting was a class of experts. Only a few could make the picture, make a portrait, and only a few could buy a portrait. For example, Andy Warhol did not become rich because he was such a successful painter. Andy Warhol became rich because his gallery had a good idea. They looked in the newspapers and said, oh, I see this industrialist in Italy, a German or France, has now 60 birthday. So let's phone his husband or her man or her, or his wife and call them, don't you want to make a good present and gift to your husband? Then they say, okay, what do you mean? We could give you a portrait by your husband. You only have to pay a little bit, let's say $200,000 to Andy Warhol. Then he flies in with his Polaroid. So Andy Warhol made about every month about a dozen of portraits in Europe. And this is now the problem. When you go to when you're invited to a collector in Germany and he's an industrialist, everybody says to you, please come to me, I show you my portraits by Andy Warhol. It gets boring, because when you have about 1,000 industrialists in Germany and then another 1,000 in France, you show portraits by Warhol, then you know why he called himself a factory. And the question is actually, if this is art, okay, you see, sir, and to make this problem aware, I made this photographic piece. This is too difficult to explain. You can make your own use. We have to go. Now we come to the next station. You see, the rewriting can go so far that people don't even know who wrote Ilias, who was Homer. We have no idea. But every decade, we have new ideas. Now, for example, there is a famous writer called Ralph Schrott. He says that Homer was not even a Greek. He translated the Iliad. And then he researched the biography, and he came out with the idea that he is, in fact, from the South Turkey. And that he was not close to Troya. I have proof that he says the idea of Troya is completely wrong. So he is in the south of Turkey from an ethnic popularity which is called Kilik. And the whole idea that Homer is a Greek writer is wrong. So naturally, 20 years again, you will have other ideas. So you see, even of our greatest writers, we don't know who wrote it. The same nature is with Shakespeare. You know all these debates, was it Francis Bacon, was this, was it that. So this is a proof that art is a constant rewriting about authorship, etc., etc. We have a collection of collective fictions. A nice example, there are many, you can believe me. Even the famous Dante, Divina Commedia, is a fable taken by the Arabs. So he writes about Christ, but in fact, everything what he writes about is stolen from a Arab history of Muhammad. It goes so far. So we have proofs that 80% of Boccaccio, of the Camerone, is translations and rewritings of Arabian fables. We call them our big Renaissance writers, but in fact, it's just rewriting of many, many other stories from many, many other cultures. The best example, a wonderful example, is the Ninth Symphony of Beethoven with a text of Friedrich Schiller, Ode to Enjoyment. Beethoven his original idea to make it a symbol of the French Revolution. This was his writing program, if you want. But since, as I said later, why should we call it? It doesn't fit. So it was the German National Socialists that made it to their own hymn too, because it was the text from Schiller. So they said, we don't care about the music, we take the text of Schiller. Then, even the German Nazi Olympiad, 1936 in Berlin, was opened with the symphony of Beethoven. But Beethoven literally invented this for democracy. Then, even the apartheid regime of Rhodesia, they took it as a national anthem. Can you imagine? There's a music programmed to represent the French Revolution, the beginning of democracy, but even the national apartheid of Rhodesia makes it to their national, makes it to their national anthem, etc., etc. You see, there's a constant rewriting in culture and in art, if you like it or not. Another wonderful example is the name of France itself, Jean-Michel. There's this famous philosopher, Condillac, a member of the French Enlightenment. He had a brother. His name was Gabriel de Mably. He wrote many books. One book was Observations through the History of France, published 1765. And he proves that the name of France is wrong because the aristocracy was from Franken, therefore Frankreich, France. But in fact, it was the people of Galicia. You remember the story of Caesar, and you remember Asterix and Obelix, one of the sources to know history. So it's Gallia. So it should not be called La France, it should be called La Galle. But naturally, the aristocracy was so strong, she just rewrote it, she just transformed everything. We call it now Frankreich with La France. And so we have many, many examples how history is constantly rewritten. Now we get a little bit now to the end, to what I promised you to say more about rewriting. Rewriting started, this is not original, but one of the major points, by a wonderful unknown mathematics from Norway. His name is Axel Due. And he made a paper in 1914 called Problems about Transformations of Chains of science, not science, science letters, after given rules. To make a short story so you understand what is going on here, this Axel Due was the source for Chomsky's famous grammar. He called his own grammar in the first writings semi two systems. And then when the first programming language by Pacus and Naur was called algorithmic language, therefore Algol. Algol is the mother of all, from COBOL to whatever, to all languages of programming. And it goes back to Tue, because he said the following. You have a finite set of letters, let's say A, B, C. Then you have two rules. A becomes B, B becomes A and B. And then you, with these two rules, you can transform these letters endlessly. And this is now, and then you want to have a proof. When I have a set, for example, you have abracadabra. Can you prove that this is enough with these two rules? And actually, this problem was unsolvable. But his ideas that you have rules went on like this. He has this rule. And suddenly he discovered this has a structure of trees. You see, A becomes A and C, etc., etc. Another structure of trees. And this was then taken up later by Aristide Lindemeyer. He created the so-called L systems, 68. Lindemeyer was a Hungarian biologist and botanist who created 1968, after Axel Due, these ideas. You have variables, so you said A, B, only two letters. So you have a start, you have the rule A becomes A, B, B becomes A, you see. So it repeats precisely that work of Axel Due. And then he creates what produces this kind of chain of letters. And then he would make another thing, Fibonacci numbers, A, B again, rules A, B, B, A, very easy things, look back. A becomes A, B, B becomes A, A becomes B, just a change, very simple rules. And with Fibonacci numbers, he could create a plant, seriously. So Axel Due mathematical systems are able to visualize everything, from clouds to plants, and everything in motion. You have now this famous digital philosophy going back to Pythagoras. You can represent the world not by numbers, by so-called algorithms. And Dewey was the first who showed us these problems, what of rules, how you can change. So he invented the idea of rewriting. And you see here, nature is just a rewriting program. So the question is, when I was successful to show you in case studies that art is another rewriting program, so the question is, what is the difference from nature to art? And the difference is only that it is a man-made rewriting program. So, for example, when you read in the magazines today, up to now we could read the genetic code, but from now on we will write it. Then it's clear after this lecture that this is wrong. We can read the genetic code, but we cannot write it. What we can do is rewrite it. You see? This is the essence. And what we can do in art, we can rewrite it. And we can hope, as I said before, when we make mistakes, and we have misunderstandings, then we have more chances to become famous. So that means deficits and what we call bugs in your rewriting program. Bugs are very good things. In nature, you call them mutation. Okay, now, but we have very soon at the end, we have better hopes than this. When we go into these rewriting systems, and this kind of grammars and formal structures, etc., the danger is that we have, the drawing of Leonardo was also a mathematical algorithm invented by Vitruv. So when you go back to this idea of rewriting chains of science, there can be the danger, formulated by Baudrillard, that signifiers, the chains, become free-floating. And that we have finally a semiocratic catastrophe. And I give you an utopian answer that how we can avoid the free-floating signifier, how we can avoid the semiotic catastrophe. We go back to Pavlov, his famous experiment with a dog, 1927, and he says precisely the sound of the bell makes the dog produce this kind of saliva. Saliva. And now we have to analyze it. What happens here? If the sound of the bell would be an index, an acoustic index, like the sound of a car. This is an index. When the sign is produced by the object itself, when the object is represented by an acoustic sign. And naturally, we are very good dogs when we are on the street and we hear a car. We can say, this is a Mercedes, this is a Bentley. We have to stop at the border. We don't cross the street, right? If we would not understand it, it's an indexical nature. As an animal, we would make a mistake and would die. But we hear sound, and this means we know the car is coming. But nature, we would not produce saliva, right? Nobody would produce saliva. Or he is an obsessive car fetishist. Can be the case. Okay. But nature, dogs are no Christians. They don't produce saliva hearing the bell of the sound of a bell. So in fact, what the dog does, the animal is a sign-processing creature. He realizes this is not an acoustic index. It's not saying the bell is ringing. He says this is a symbol. So the dog knows precisely. This is not saying the bell is coming. He's saying the food is coming. So he's able, as a dog even, to say this is a representation of a symbol. Because a symbol, according to Pierce and all the others, is when the relation between the object and the sign is arbitrary. So that in fact means next time you show the dog a picture of Elvis Presley of the Himalaya, and immediately afterwards you give him food, after 10 times making the same experiment, he would have saliva looking at Elvis Presley or looking at the photograph of Himalaya. Because the relationship of the object and the sign is always arbitrary. This is a fact, proven for 100 years in science theory. Okay, so the production of saliva shows that the signifier can be arbitrary. You can take any object what you see. Therefore, it's a good idea that Coca-Cola once said, made an advertising and saying X is Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola is a free variable because everybody could project everybody on it. So what you see here is an explanation. The signifier is not an index. The signifier is a symbol and means meat and food is coming. Okay, and now comes the real point when we accept this. As I said at the beginning, Roman Jakobson is the most important linguist of the 20th century because he goes back to the founder of semiotics, Charles Sanders Peirce. He made this wonderful sentence, "A thing without oppositions ipso facto does not exist. A thing without an opposite does not exist." And now he transported it to the theory of sign. He said, "A sign without opposition has no meaning." And he calls it binary opposition. He said, all the distinct features in our language, from morphemes to phonemes, whatever we utter, all the distinctive features in all our utterances are governed by two values only, plus and minus. When we say hot, we have to say also cold. When we say loud, we also have to say silent. There's always this binary opposition. It goes back to Peirce. He says, a thing without opposition does not exist. And say next step, a sign without opposition doesn't make meaning. So he shows that from the grammar to the level of morphemes and phonology, you have always two distinctions. That means when I would throw in this kind of cube a vocal, the vocal has to make a decision in front or in the back, high or low, rounded or not rounded, nasal or not nasal. There is no other chance. So he says, okay, our language is a binary opposition, or if you want, a contrary binarism. And when you believe this, and this, I recommend you to believe it, then you have a chance to understand the world better. I give you an example. You see, there's many, when you go out now after this lecture, you will see it all the time. There's an advertising saying, get a part-time job with a company car, but you look at the tank. What does it do? A car, as we know, is the mobility of the individual. It's a symbol for America. Everybody wants to have a car to be an individual driving. So, but the military is a collective, and it's not a company. And the tank is not a car. But what happened here is precisely what I said before. Not only the sound and the vocal and etc., but even the signifier is not free-floating. The signifier is a prisoner of binary opposition or opposite binarism. That means when you hear music, you think of silence. Therefore, John Cage made a very famous book about music called it Silence. And here's the same. But to make it simple, the signifier is not free-floating. The signifier can only ring the bell at the neighbor signifier. He's not alone. Whatever he does, the neighbor is informed. Therefore, when somebody wants to see, they wanted to make something in favor of a military company, and they took just the opposite. And therefore, it is so convincing. So the idea is, please rewrite me. Please, can you again ask a question?
I was listening in your talk. If you take away the female artist that you invented and the female artist to whom you gave the best ideas, then we're left with a story that has almost no female artists or writers in it at all.
I said at the beginning that Baron could have been the author of the work by Duchamp. So I think naturally, this is an important point what you mentioned, that in the 70s it started, precisely what my argument is, the rewriting of Artariste from the feminist point of view, precisely. Because this is what I say, this is my argument, that Artariste is not something stable, it's something dynamic which is constantly written. And feminism was one of the attempts to write it. But my critique of feminism is not feminist theory from the practical point of view, that in the beginning, in the 70s. One of the ideas was that feminism is one of the strategies to dissolve the problem of power. That means maybe even to abolish power. But after a while, we can realize that feminism did not want to destroy power or to abolish power, she just wanted to be part of power. You understand? And this is, so the rewriting was just an idea, how could I get into power? And it looks like this in art. For example, myself, in my museum, and I'm grateful for the chance that I can talk about it, I constantly show forgotten women. Maybe you've seen it, I did a book several years ago about Gego and Ruth Vollmer, and I was Gertrud Goldschmidt, and I was wondering why nobody has done it before. Now, after 3 years, we have a show by Gego in New York, in the Drawing Center. And I did it even in English. I had not one single review in Germany, not one single. Not one feminist paper, nobody wrote about it. We have two major books. It took me and Nadia Rotner 3 years to make the research. And actually, this is clear that even the feminists there stopped doing the research because now they're in power. They now have all the positions in universities and in galleries. And now they're going back to mainstream art and not going to continue. I wish that people feminists would go on rewriting art history. There are so many artists still to discover. One of the cases I'm now preparing is Ursula Meyer. Does it say something to you? Yeah. Did you have, can I ask you what you know from her?
Well, I would actually like to...
No, this is the point here.
Because I'm not suggesting that you haven't worked with...
This is a theoretical point of view. There are so many agendas. I could speak about colonial artists, about black artists, etc. So I had only 1 hour. It's not an ideology, but a few. Just I wanted to concentrate on the points which could be more easily to be understood. So from my point of view, it was no ideological reason. So my point of view was just to show examples which I can assume that people could follow the argument.